Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
My mother always says that she is happy that her kids were born in the United States. My siblings and I are first gen. And I say that because we are the first to start the generational cycle within the United States. And for me, her saying that, you know, holds a lot of weight and also a lot of freedom. Having U.S. citizenship is not something that I think about often when I'm applying to job applications, when I'm applying to school, when I'm accessing healthcare. I'm a traveler, you know, having a U.S. passport is huge. It gives me access to a lot of privileges in the world just by being a U.S. citizen. It is something that I don't have to worry about. And I don't have the experience of being undocumented. However, this freedom that I exercise every single day has not always been my family story. There were so many people, including my mother, who came to the United States and was undocumented, and a lot of people have paved the way for me in order for me to exercise these freedoms that I have today. I think one of the most important things is also naming that being undocumented is not an experience that is tied only to the United States. There are undocumented people all over the world, and a lot of the times their stories, their contributions, and their experience is not necessarily heard. And today we are going to have a conversation with my best friend Alonso, who came to the United States as a child and was undocumented in the United States.
The time I realized it's the U.S. context that constrains me. Is the U.S. context that prevents me from finding a job. Of course, there were many resources that I was able to tap into in the U.S., but there were a lot of constraints as well afterwards. So that's the idea of how it came up. Well, if I can make it, quote unquote, in the U.S., I'm pretty sure that there's other places, other countries where I can try and, you know, find a job and basically live a normal life, not a life that is kind of a second-class citizen of the U.S., not a life not in the shadows, a life not, you know, a life without fear.
On the season of The Labyrinth of the First Gen, we will explore a conversation about what we carry with us and what we redefine. We are pioneers just by simply existing.
My name is Alonso Alvarez. I was born in Mexico and grew up in the U.S. in California. I am 34 years old. And I am currently living in France. And in terms of work, I work at the University of Lille.
When you hear the words first generation, what comes to mind for you?
First generation, it can be very, let's say, diverse in terms of definition. I take it as being the first one within your family to do something. It could be going to college. It could be living outside of your home city. It could be, you know, going abroad. It could be many different things, but at the essence, how I define first generation is someone who is doing something for the first time and doesn't count with the resources, whether economic or, you know, guidance from their family. I grew up, you know, in the U.S., and so that was, I grew up saying I'm the first generation. Well, it's kind of hard to explain whether I'm first generation or half generation, but I was the first generation to go to the U.S., to the public school in the U.S. I was the first one from within my family to go to college. I was the first one to, you know, get a professional job, quote unquote, where you are in an office sitting in a chair all day rather than outside breaking your back. So I could go on and on. There's plenty of examples that I can cite of how I am first generation. Lately, I can say I'm the first generation of my family in that I decided to leave the U.S. and go abroad, work abroad. And most recently, I'm the first generation of my family to live in Europe for the second time to do, let's say, how do I put it? Like, I am first generation again because I decided to migrate again and start from zero in another country and learn a language and learn a culture and just learn a new way of living. So that's more or less how first generation can apply to me.
What was the experience like of being undocumented in the United States?
So I was like I said, I was born in Mexico and my parents decided to go to the U.S. and when I was 10, I joined them and I didn't have documents. So for 16 years, I basically, all my life in the U.S., I lived as an undocumented person. So being undocumented in the U.S. is something that it's there. You cannot see it, you cannot touch it, but you feel it. You basically, it's hard to explain if you have never experienced that. But basically, everything from studying, driving, traveling, opening a bank account, working, is conditioned by your status. So that means that everything is filtered through that lens. Your day-to-day life is conditioned by not having documents. So people like to say that you were an illegal immigrant. Well, nobody's illegal, it's just you don't have the documents. So my whole life in the U.S. was that. So from school, I knew right away that my parents would tell me, you don't have papers, right? What does that mean? When you're a child, you don't really understand. I think I really, really felt it when I was 16, and that's when people start going to... They start taking the class to take a driver's license, because that's like a rite of passage. You start realizing that that doesn't apply to you, so that's the first thing. Then you really, really feel it when you start thinking about going to college. When you're a junior or a senior, I had the chance of having really, really good grades. So all my peers were applying to college. All my counselors were saying, you need to go to college. I mean, I come from a disadvantaged background. I went to a high school with a majority, you know, immigrant students. So there, the idea of going to university is already very low. You add the variable of being undocumented, and practically at that point, at that time, it was practically impossible. So basically that's when I really felt it, because it wasn't, for me, it was, they couldn't understand why I was hesitant to apply to college. They thought it was maybe because my parents or my family didn't push me to go to college. That's not true. They really wanted me to go as far as I could go. This idea of not feeling safe, not feeling comfortable, saying, well, I am undocumented.
Alonso explained that being undocumented and being in a first generation experience also meant that you couldn't necessarily turn to people in your community to answer any of your questions or concerns.
So that's where the whole first generation dimension can be applied, in that, well, I couldn't talk to my family of the obstacles that I faced because they themselves only have like a sixth grade education. They didn't have the privilege of going to school in Mexico. So at home, there is no resources, whether economic or just guidance. And at school, there is the guidance, there is the counselors, there is teacher, but you cannot not trust them, not in that sense, but you don't feel comfortable telling them. So you are kind of an undocumented student with good grades that is stuck.
His undocumented status became even more profound once he left high school.
And then once you decide to leave high school, well, it's time to work. That's when you really, really feel like, okay, your grades don't matter, your skills don't matter. What matters is if you have a valid social security number and a green card or an American passport. And that's when it really hits you in the face that your status, it's really defines everything. Before, you could hide behind the status of being a student. You could kind of blend in with your colleagues because, well, you're going to school. You can have good grades just like your colleagues, your fellow students. You might not be able to go to field trips outside of the U.S., but at least you're able to kind of follow along and say, I'm a student, I'm a high school student. Once you graduate and you become an adult, that identity is taken away from you. And you become an undocumented immigrant who has skills, whether skills at a high school level, language skills, or you're still working in the jobs that pay the least, the jobs that would hire you. So that's when you really start feeling that your status matters a lot.
What were some of the obstacles and challenges that you faced after you graduated high school?
Yeah, so after I finished high school, I felt like, you know, I have to go to find a job. It's, you know, I worked in a supermarket for many years, and then eventually I was able to overcome some obstacles with help of colleagues from work, with friends, with, you know, resources in the community, and I managed to go to college with a scholarship, with private scholarships, and then I finished my bachelor's degree in history and international relations, and I'm back to zero. I'm hitting the fate, like my status, it's a constraint. No matter if now I have a bachelor's degree, no matter that I graduated with honors, I cannot find a professional job. So at this point, throughout college, the idea of leaving the U.S. started to become more and more concrete.
In an article in American Psychology Today called Undocumented Americans, there's the constant stressful experiences of racial profiling, ongoing discrimination, the experience of the constant threat of being forcefully taken or separated from their families. And this can lead to outcomes including anxiety, fear, depression. But also something that was mentioned was that there was a lack of the sense of belonging.
I did history, so I know more about U.S. history than Mexican history. I felt like, you know, I was very integrated and everything, but yet I wasn't accepted. I mean, I was blocked everywhere. I tried to find a job, I tried to find a way to sustain myself, you know, to find a career, and everywhere there was obstacles.
So I am curious about, when did the idea to leave the United States start?
The idea of leaving the U.S. came up because I learned from high school, like after I graduated high school, it was difficult to get a job. I graduated from university with a bachelor's degree and an honors degree. I couldn't get a job. So it was like really a clear answer for me that, well, if I can't do anything in the U.S., I would try to leave and find something else outside. So that's how more or less the idea came up, of little by little saying there is no future for me in the U.S. There is a future, but there's a lot of obstacles. And based on my previous experience, I felt like I was tired and I didn't see a bright future or a guaranteed future.
Alonso met many teachers and mentors and professors along the way that began planting seeds around the ideas of him leaving the United States to study abroad to escape his documentation status.
When I finished my bachelor's degree, I had good professors who advised me to apply to do a master's abroad, to kind of reset, to escape away from that status, because sometimes you grow up with that status and you really can't escape it to the point that you feel like it's there permanently. But that's not the case. Over time, I realized it's the U.S. context that constrains me. It's the U.S. context that prevents me from finding a job. Of course, there were many resources that I was able to tap into in the U.S., but there were a lot of constraints as well afterwards. So that's the idea of how it came up. Well, if I can make it, quote unquote, in the U.S., I'm pretty sure there's other places, other countries where I can try and, you know, find a job and basically live a normal life, not a life that is kind of a second-class citizen of the U.S., not a life not in the shadows, a life not, you know, a life without fear.
After his bachelor's degree, he applied to master's programs in the U.K., and he got accepted. However, this didn't come without any challenges.
So by the end of the time I finished my bachelor's degree, I applied right away before the end of my senior year in the university to master programs in the UK. So I got this lucky. I applied to 13. All of them accepted me, but no scholarship. It took a year until I got the good news that I was accepted with a scholarship. So that's how I had one foot outside of the US and one foot in, because even though I had a ticket out, I was admitted, I had a way to cover the fees. There was still, the idea of like, am I really going to take this step? Am I really going to leave everything behind in the US to go to the UK? Because yes, it's a start from zero. I will leave all the constraints behind, but I will also leave all the things I love and all the things that I built in the US. I will leave my home. And so by the end of the 2000, I graduated in 2012. In May 2013, I got the scholarship to go to the UK, and it was time to decide, do I let go the opportunity of the scholarship and stay in the US, or do I take this chance and leave to the UK?
At the same time that Alonso was pondering his decision, leaving the United States to study in the UK, DACA, which stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Immigration Policy, was passed by executive action in June 2012 by President Obama.
Good afternoon, everybody. This morning, Secretary Napolitano announced new actions my administration will take to mend our nation's immigration policy, to make it more fair, more efficient, and more just, specifically for certain young people, sometimes called dreamers. The Department of Homeland Security is taking steps to lift the shadow of deportation from these young people.
This policy allowed undocumented immigrants who arrived in the United States at a young age to become eligible for a work permit, a social security card, a driver's license, and deferred deportation.
If you arrived to the U.S. before you were 16 and you finished minimum high school, you would allow to, it was kind of like, it wasn't a clear answer to citizenship, but it was kind of like a halfway, because your status technically didn't change. You were still undocumented, but the government said that you would have the right to work. They would provide a social security number. You were safe to travel within the U.S. And if for some reason border control or immigration forces stop you, you were cool. You had DACA. You were in the good list of immigrants. You were a good immigrant. You were an educated immigrant. So, that's how the program kind of started. I don't remember exactly where I was when I read the news, but I know that during college, there was a whole movement of the Dreamer movement.
The Dreamer movement came as a result of a policy. The Dreamer policy stands for Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors under the Dreamers Act. And this policy would have created a process by which immigrants could apply for conditional residency that will lead to permanent residency based on their age of entry into the United States. However, despite numerous attempts from 2001 to 2021, the act failed to pass through Congress. But it led to many actually undocumented young people on college campuses to organize.
So, I was part of Facebook groups. I was part of following fellow friends in university. And as soon as the news dropped, everybody kind of started sharing this information. If you were 16 years or younger and graduated high school, you had the right to apply for this program. At that moment in 2012, when the programs first started, it wasn't really well known. Nobody really knew under which conditions you could apply for that or not. But at least it allowed, the whole undocumented community that benefited from it started saying, I am undocumented, but I am DACA-mented.
But there was also a lot of fear of what it meant to be undocumented and apply for DACA.
There was a lot of fear. Are we willingly going to give all our information to the government? You know, because you have to, I mean, it's the U.S. government at the end, so they ask you to provide your name, your birth certificate, everything, to be in the system officially. And so there was some hesitation from some, you know, some people. I think for me was, it can't get any worse.
Despite not having all of the resources or all of the information, Alonso figured out how to first and how to apply for DACA and tap into the resources in his community on his own.
So I decided to apply for it. And, you know, we don't have the resources to hire a lawyer. So I had to learn myself. Like, I had to keep up with the legislation. I tap into the resources of the Dreamers movement. You know, I grew up in California, so I went to San Francisco for some workshops. And I learned myself how to navigate the procedure, what kind of documents did they ask. It's not the most complex procedure, but once again, if you don't have someone from within your circle of friends or family to say, you have to do it like this, you have to do it like that, it's up to you to inform yourself, or it's up to you to reach out, to go out of your comfort zone. Again, that is one of the prices to pay when you're first generation. I informed myself, me and my two brothers, well, my other brother was also eligible. We sent the application for DACA. I don't remember like how long it takes. It was a while, but it took some months. You know, there was an online platform where you have to log in, and I would refresh that page so many times just to see, because you could see your status there.
We're going to take a quick pause and continue the conversation when we return. The Labyrinth of the First Gen would like to announce a call to action. We hope that you are currently enjoying the show, and we want to hear feedback from you. So if you are listening on this show on any of iTunes platforms, Spotify, as well as Google Podcasts, please rate the show. Let us know what you think. And as they say, sharing is caring. So share this episode with a friend. And we are back. This is the Labyrinth of the First Gen. What was the experience like when you received the notification that you received DACA?
All of a sudden, I have a social security number. All of a sudden, I can go and, you know, not be afraid of driving. There were many things that, like you said, magically ended when I got DACA, you know. All the opportunities of applying for a job, all of a sudden it was possible.
Once Alonso learned the procedure to apply for the DACA, he began to help other people in his community, both friends and his family.
So, you know, once I got the card and once I got my social security number, I started helping people out, because at the university or at the community college where I worked, I met some friends, and, you know, you kind of start forming a community, a support group. And so I first started helping people that I knew directly from high school or from the university. And then the second wave of people that I would help would be kind of the sons or the daughters of friends of my sisters or my mother or my uncle or my aunt, that their children were in high school. They still hadn't finished high school, but they were eligible. They were eligible to apply for DACA, but they really felt lost because the children were not, like, their children were a little bit too young to navigate the legal system, and they don't have the resources to hire a lawyer to go beyond.
Obama's administration passing DACA did have an influence on Alonso's pending decision on whether he was going to stay in the United States and continue to be documented, as they say, to be with, you know, live with DACA, or if he would still consider leaving to the UK.
I was documented back in 2012. I was documented. I had my driver's license and I work at a community college. So that kind of opened the door. I still have this thing in my head. And okay, is that enough for you? Should you be happy now? Because everything that I just mentioned didn't apply anymore. I could find a job. I could drive. I could fly if I wanted to, right? So the question then, do I want this or do I want to leave and take the opportunity that of going to study in the UK, a master's program that was fully funded?
Lonzo began looking into opportunities. Was there a way for him to keep DACA or continue to be documented, as they say, as well as leave and to study in the UK?
There were some catches. The first one is this document doesn't allow you to leave the US and come back. There is another procedure. They establish another procedure for that, you know, I'd call advanced parole.
Advanced parole is a procedure in which you can get permission as an undocumented person to leave the United States. It's crazy because the language that is used, advanced parole, is as if you are a prisoner.
Yeah.
So when did you officially decide to leave the United States? What made you make that decision?
Sometimes ignorance is bliss. I wasn't enough ignorant because through that workshop that I've attended to learn how to navigate the process for asking for DACA, how when I did my research for advanced parole, I learned that it was that DACA wasn't a bill from Congress. It was done by a presidential decision, executive decision, which means that the president gives you and the president takes back. I knew that Obama was the one that was there, but I also knew that Obama was there. I mean, luckily he was there for a year. But you don't know what's gonna come next. And you know, at that point it was 2012, but I knew that you couldn't trust it. Like it wasn't a law passed by Congress. Even if a law was passed, they can always revoke it, but it wasn't something that was, to a certain extent, that was gonna last for a while. And you know, that was my thought back then. And sure enough, Trump came to power. What does he want to do? He wants to destroy DACA or, you know, stop it from going. And there was a time when the courts stepped in and, you know, this whole thing. And for me, it was, I think that, but it was like, that was part of the decision why I decided to leave, but also because for me, it was too little too late. For me, it had been years, you know, since I was a junior in college, that I started saying, life doesn't end outside of the US. I didn't know that for that, but I was curious enough and I wanted to see. And I said, if I am not able to, that, at least that was the way that I thought, if I'm not able to do what I want, to achieve my goals, either professionally, personally, here, the world, there's other places, there's other countries. So, and like I said, there was already a path out. It was really a way to continue my studies in the UK. It was a combining the whole idea of studying abroad and continuing my studies, and they were funded. So it was really hard not to say no, because if I said no, I knew the kind of life the US was, right? And even though I had the right to work now and I was safe to, I was still caged in a certain extent. I couldn't leave outside the US, right? So that was more or less the reason why I thought a lot about it a lot, and I said, I am going to take this chance, and I'll figure it out the rest later. And in August 2012, I took the decision to leave the US, and I left my home in California almost 10 years ago.
He talked about what happened after he completed his master's degree after a year in the UK, and the decisions he had to make at that time.
And once again, after the UK, once I finished my master's degree, what am I going to do? Because the idea of going back to the US, even though I wanted to, or I felt like it, is not an option. So I found an internship opportunity in Brazil. I had no home to go back to, right? So I was free. That was the idea behind it, because once I gave up the idea of being home, then you're not attached to a specific place. Yes, Mexico was my, I mean, and now I can say it was my home country. I'm Mexican, I am from there, but there is very little links there. I found an internship opportunity in Brazil, and that's how I met you. So that was a good thing as well. I ended up staying there for almost 1 year. Then, you know, my master's was in international development. The whole idea was to work, gain experience. The whole idea was to work in international development. I ended up working with NGOs. After Brazil, I went to Ecuador. After Ecuador, I went to Cambodia. After Cambodia, I went to Thailand. After Thailand, I went to Peru. After Peru, I went to Turkey. And in Turkey, I realized, okay, this method of changing countries very often, sometimes as often as 3 months, 4 months, it's great. I travel, I learn, you know, I learn skills because I had to work, but the most important knowledge that I got was really, really being outside of my comfort zone and talking to people. And that was something that I don't regret at all, because that's something that, you know, that was one of my intended goals when I decided to leave the US. So it was a bet that I wanted to see the world, and to a certain extent I succeeded. But after 5 years more or less of moving and traveling, the idea of finding a place to be my new home started to come up more and more often. So in 2018, when I was in Turkey, that the next country, at least, that I would change the way I would live my life, and that I need to find a place where I felt comfortable and good enough to try to stay for a while and to make it my home.
What is your experience like living in France as an immigrant?
My experience of living here in France as an immigrant, I think I live here long enough to say that this is my second major migration outside of the US. In the US, I spent so much time there, and I could compare from Mexico. Now here, to a certain extent, it's been 5 years since I lived here. So I do kind of, over time, I do see myself, I don't think I would ever say I'm French, but to a certain extent, France is becoming my home. Something that in the US, I had a home in California, but it was a home by force. And to a certain extent, I had to assert myself. I had to defend that I belong there. Here, it's like here, whatever I say, it's not objective, because someone, you know, maybe someone who went to the US with documents as an immigrant, they would tell you a whole different story than what I tell you about the US. So the same thing as me, for me here, it was pretty much easy to come to France, right? Here, we're welcome, like, in the sense of, with my passport, I can travel all the way to you. I don't even need a visa, right?
In talking about Alonso's experience as an immigrant in France, he did acknowledge his privilege.
I am speaking from a point of privilege, because I am a welcome immigrant because I have documents and I went to study. Again, I found myself in the excellent good immigrant list, right? And I am a minority within a minority of immigrants. There's not a lot of Latin Americans here, or even Mexicans, or however you want to, whatever label you want to put me. And we are a minority within a minority. And sometimes when you are a minority within a minority, the focus is not on you, right? So to a certain extent, there is that difference. In the US, you know, being undocumented, you're not only an immigrant, but there's a big sticker saying undocumented. So here, there is only the immigrant part, and there is no undocumented attached to it. So my experience is not objective, because I know that maybe, and I've seen, not personally, but I know that there is undocumented people. There's undocumented people everywhere. And even though I'm an immigrant, you're an immigrant. We don't have a lot of many of you, you know. So the perception, and that's something else that I learned. The way that you are viewed varies from country to country. So, for example, here if you say Mexico, some people say drugs, hotels. Other people think, hot weather, nice vacation time, you know. And that's something that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily hear that about the U.S. In the U.S., sometimes you hear Mexican undocumented, drug dealer, cholo, you know, all these things. So that's something else that I realized, that as I move from country to country, it matters a lot the way that people view a specific region or a specific country. And here, you know, whenever someone talks to me, I have an accent, but I have a particular accent, so that's okay. There's not an accent associated with certain ways, so that changes everything. So to a certain extent, that's something that I experienced. While in the US, it's like you are a majority within the minority, right? So that was something else that I would see the differences.
What are some similarities that you see between France and the United States when it comes to conversations around immigration?
I think that story is universal. That I can tell you that if you are an immigrant, there's always the good immigrants and the bad immigrants, and the same story applies here in France. If you went to school and, to be honest, if you went to school and come from a certain country, you're seen or you're put in a good immigrant list. The ones that are not a threat, the ones that merit, you know, the ones that deserve the visa, because that's always the way they work. A lot of the things that I am experiencing is because of the fact that, not only because I am educated like you, because in the US I was educated as well, it's for the simple fact that I think two reasons. One, because I have the papers, the documents, you know, I have a residence permit, I speak French, I integrated, I am, you know, here they call it, I am a child of the French Republic, right? But I think as well is because I am a minority within a minority, right? I think, like I said, in the US, and this is something that I hear, like sometimes whenever I hear conversations or debates, there's a lot of similarities when they refer to immigrants, you know, like, oh, they don't integrate, they don't speak French, or they want to keep their ways. This is the same story that I would hear in the US. But that doesn't apply to me all of a sudden. Why? Because I don't come from the majority of, like here in France, I don't know, I don't have the statistics or the research, but here, whenever people think of immigrants, they think of people from North Africa or from the French-speaking countries. That's what they think of whenever they think of immigrants, because they don't think of immigrants as, you know, someone from Germany, that's next door, or Spain, that's next door. It's always this idea of, like, immigrants is someone who doesn't look French, quote unquote. And here, like I said, like the debate, there's similarities to the ones that we hear in the US, but all of a sudden I don't find myself within that group that discourse is applied to. That is one of the main differences that I see here. And of course, the second one, like I mentioned, is that here I technically don't have any restraints other than, I mean, there's still systematic restraints that are systematic with the racism and stuff, but at least in terms of documents, I am free to apply to wherever I want to.
So knowing what you know now with your experience and your decision to leave the United States as a young, undocumented person, what kind of advice would you give undocumented youth, whether states or outside of the United States?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question to answer. For me, it was a very personal choice to leave the U.S. I don't think I can say to anyone, if you're tired of the U.S., just leave. Because it doesn't come easy. I mean, like I said, I'm happy with my choice. I don't regret the experience that I got, the fact that I'm now living outside of the U.S. and I do see myself in a happier place, let's say. But there was a big, big price to pay. And that price was that I haven't seen my family in 10 years, right? So this is not some advice that I can easily give to anyone who might consider living in the U.S. if they find themselves constrained in that golden cage that is the U.S. But what I can tell them is, like, if they really feel like it's the end, I mean, the end in that they don't see themselves overcoming whatever obstacle they face because they are either undocumented or documented but still limited because, you know, they don't know, there is a life outside of the U.S. There are places outside of the U.S. When we grow up in the U.S., we grow up thinking we are number one. And we are in terms of, you know, military, in terms of school, in terms of thing, in terms of healthcare, no. In terms of holidays, no. But you cannot know that if you don't leave the U.S., right? So I'm not saying, like I said, once again, I'm not saying that you need to leave the U.S., but I think if you find yourself that that you try many options and you see yourself stuck and you feel like you're stuck and there's no way to go, leaving the U.S. on your own terms is not easy. But it's possible, and there is life outside of the U.S. There is other places where you can find a home, where you can find that you belong, and a place where you can just continue your life and not be constrained by your status or by any limitation based on the way that you look or the way that you know, any kind of constraints. I'm not saying that it will happen automatically. It's not easy. It takes a lot of work. But, you know, the American dream is not just, doesn't exist just within the U.S. You could have a dream and achieve it somewhere else. So that's more or less what I would say.
I want to
to say Sereme and thank you, Alonso, for being here and sharing your wisdom. We have one more episode left of this season. I will be launching a trailer of the second season in the last episode. So super excited to share that. And we also want to be in community with you. So if you haven't already, please check out my website at labyrinthfirstgen.com. Again, labyrinthfirstgen.com. And add me on Instagram at labyrinthatthefirstgen. As I always say, be in peace, folk. And see you later. Thank you for listening.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.